Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick, Behind the Curtain. Now, ordinarily, at this point, I say it's my opportunity to leave the world of politics and law that I cover every day on television to talk about other things like theater and the arts. Well, we're not going that far today from the world of politics and the law for this interview, but it's totally worth it because having just read a book by one of my favorite people, you become one of my favorite people without questions. It is a book called Attack from Within by Professor Barbara McQuaid, who many of you may know as one of the hashtag sisters in law, along with my friend Jill Wine Banks and others. But Barb, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. Congratulations on what is a best-selling book. I've written 15. Not one has ever hit bestseller.
Thanks very much, Paul. I'm glad to be here with you.
And of course, people can catch you all the time on MSNBC, and now you're all around the country promoting the book. We did this on the Midday News. People who want to watch a little of that can go to the web and see that. But the first question I asked you there, and I want to ask you here, is that people seem to confuse the terms misinformation, disinformation. Donald Trump himself will say, they're a little different. But explain to my viewers and listeners, what's the difference? Because they're different.
Yeah, you know, some people will use these terms interchangeably. But I wanted to define them differently as because I use them differently in the book. And so to me, disinformation is defined as the deliberate use of lies or misleading words to deceive and manipulate other people. Misinformation is sort of its unwitting cousin. When people in good faith repeat information they've heard, not knowing that it is false. And so in that way, people who are, innocent actors can unintentionally pass on disinformation without even realizing it.
What surprised me in the book in terms of what I didn't know we would get this, but we get a bit of a history lesson too, because I don't think anybody's even heard of disinformation or misinformation, thinking it's all tied to the Trump years and our last few years of existence. You actually take us back to Federalist 63 and James Madison, where you say, yeah, let's go back to the beginnings of this country, because even there, Madison warned of, I'm going to give a quote that you gave, which is, it warned of risk of being misled by artful misrepresentations of interested men. I guess we could say, and women.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly this fear has been out there all along. When you have a free society and when you have free speech, there is the risk that people will come along and act in their self-interest and tell us lies. And of course, what's changed about this now from the time of the nation's founding is the ability to use social media to send a message that can reach people instantly, can reach millions of people, and can even do so anonymously with a false persona. So this risk that we were warned of at the time of the founding has now grown exponentially.
Is part of the risk or the increase in that risk, you know, look, when you read something in the newspaper, which some of us still read, it came with an extensive degree of credibility with it because it's the newspaper and newspapers don't lie and all of that. But today there's two problems. Number one, we go on social media, as you know, oftentimes read a headline or a bullet point and that becomes our total information source. But secondly, because people can put anything on the media, there's no reliability. We can't trust that we're reading a relied upon source, call it the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or whatever we might be reading.
Yeah, there are a number of issues. You know, one is just information overload. Because there's so much information coming at us, it's difficult for us to process all that we're reading. And so we might rely on a headline that might be drafted more for clickbait than for accuracy. And so the headline might make the story sound more sensational than it really is. Sometimes there are sources online that are not as credible as some of the trusted brands in journalism. And that's because people create fake sites that make it look good. There was one that was created by Macedonian operatives that was called the Denver Guardian. It had all kinds of fake news stories and it looked real, but nobody realized there was no such newspaper as the Denver Guardian. So there is the ability to trick and deceive online that I think didn't exist in newspapers that were published. And then I think the other thing, Paul, about all the information on social media is, unlike what we read in the newspaper, which is all out there for everybody to see, you can rebut it when it's in the newspaper. And so if there's something that's not true, people can speak out. They can write a letter to the editor and say that that claim is not true. Online, there are so many claims, and so many of us are in our own little world, our own little bubble, that only we see our social media feeds, and other people don't see what we see. And so if we're seeing outrageous claims, it may be that opponents of those claims are never able to rebut them because they're never able to see them.
Is there not also a danger? You know, one of the things that former President Trump has done relatively recently, that at least that gets note, is that he'll send out articles on his Truth Social feed. He'll send out articles, but then it becomes clear he's modified them. He's manipulated them. He's removed some of the facts that might not put him in a positive light. I guess that falls in the same category of disinformation, but it's a little bit different because it's not just made up stuff. It's edited stuff that is based in what may have been a truthful article.
Yeah, you know, you can really change the whole flavor of an article by removing a single word, right? If the word is not, it can change the meaning of something completely. You know, omission is a way of engaging in disinformation. The failure to report certain things, that can be a type of disinformation. And so, you know, the way Donald Trump uses Truth Social is a way to you know, yell through a megaphone about his latest grievance and, you know, often cite maybe a germ of truth to support what he is saying, but only a germ, and then to go off in some other direction with something that is misleading, insulting, undermining of credibility in institutions, and something that is self-serving. But there are many people who follow him on Truth Social and believe what he says to be true.
I want to point out that not too long from now, we will talk about some of the solutions. You don't just put the problems out there and point it. You give us some solutions. So that, for my listeners and viewers, is coming in just a little bit. But one of the things we didn't really have time to do on television on the midday news is you spell out in the book how it is that those who disinform gain their power. And the first of these really just scared me completely because you say they appeal to emotion over reason, because they have to cultivate loyalty. And, you know, sometimes the way people try and deal with, whether it's Uncle Fred at the, you know, holiday dinner table or whatever it is, it's sort of, let me be reasonable. Let me give you facts. And the problem is the disinformation is put the reason aside over in favor of emotion.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's certainly part of it, is appealing to emotion, not logic. It's not about reason. And also preying on people's fears is another big part of this. I am going to prey on your worst fear. And so whatever those divisions are in society, your fear of, you know, a shrinking white population, a fear of Christian values, whatever it is, I'm not going to reassure you. What I'm going to do is I am going to make it sound far worse than even beyond your wildest imagination. And I am going to demonize those other people that might present some concern for you. I'm going to demonize minorities and immigrants and the LGBTQ community. And I'm not just going to tell you their difference. I'm going to tell you they're trying to groom your children for pedophilia. And so in this way, I have validated all those fears you always had, sort of. I have now laid out there why they are so bad. They're even worse than you thought. You were right all along. And so that validates those fears. And people feel it, find it refreshing. Boy, I've been thinking those things, but only he is willing to say them out loud. And he becomes a cult hero. And so now people might not believe him, but they believe in him. And so they want to support him. And when Donald Trump says things like, I could shoot people on Fifth Avenue and not lose any voters, that's what he's talking about. They may not literally believe the lies, but they believe in him, and they're willing to go along with whatever lie it takes to support him and his vision of America.
And of course, even if he or other people come up short, in other words, you say, everybody in Mexico is sending us our rapists and murderers and all of that, all you need is that one incident in the paper where somebody has killed somebody or whatever, and then it's all true.
Yeah. One of the phrases that's used, it's a debater's trick. It's called the part whole fallacy. And that is, if any part of something has a feature that is true, I can attribute it to the whole or a party, organization, group, or whatever it is, and portray them as all possessing that characteristic. So, you know, when in 2020, there were some members of the Democratic Party who wanted to defund the police, Donald Trump took that little germ of a fact and said, Joe Biden wants to defund the police. The radical Democrat left wants to defund the police. Now, it resonates with people because they've heard, like, oh, you know what? I did hear somebody say that. I saw an interview on the news and there was somebody who was talking about defund the police. I saw a headline. Huh, I guess it's that whole Democratic Party that wants to do that. And in fact, it's not. So that's why it's the whole part fallacy, taking one little part and assuming it applies to the whole. It's just like the example you just gave, Paul, which is, has an immigrant ever committed a crime? Yes, of course. And so you find the most egregious example you can, you know, murdering a jogger while out running, you know, is an awful crime. And it's something that is frightening to many people. And so you hold that one up as this is what immigrants do. Even though, you know, as a member of the population, immigrants commit fewer crimes than non-immigrants, perhaps because they're trying to avoid the police or they've come to this country for opportunity and the last thing they want to do is blow it, whatever the reason. But if you can find just a few incidents that you can hold up, then there is some evidence that you can use to support that narrative that everybody who is coming from Mexico is a criminal. And people who pay only casual attention to the news, they say, oh, well, there you go. There's an example.
So those who use logic or you know, have academia in their background, as I do as well, that's the easy part, so to speak, which is to say, if somebody has a belief and I can play on that, the part that I find almost inexplicable, but you'll have the answer, is how do you take people who universally are core beliefs about certain people like Putin or, you know, or China or whether it's the countries, and let's even throw Hitler in there. You know, there is no more evil person in all of history than Adolf Hitler. And yet somehow those who believe in former President Trump, for example, when they hear that he says, well, Hitler wasn't all that bad, or his chief of staff hears him say that. And yet all of that can somehow be dismissed, or they turn it around, or it's a good idea to be friendly with Putin. That is a good thing, like Trump says. Is it if the source is credible that even if what he says is completely false, it doesn't matter?
Yeah, it's a really troubling thing. You know, I saw it was actually more of a comedy sketch than anything, but where people were told that Joe Biden had said something or done something. And they asked the person what they thought about that. And they would say, these are Trump supporters. That's terrible. It's awful. It just demonstrates why he's unqualified to serve as president of the United States. And then the reporter would say, oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Actually, I misspoke. I made a mistake. It was Donald Trump who said and did that. I'm sorry. So now what was your reaction to that? Oh, well, you know, it's perfectly understandable. So it goes back to this idea that they believe in him. They don't really care. They're willing to overlook mistakes to rationalize and justify behavior because he shares their identity and their vision of what America should be. And they're willing to cast aside facts and logic because he has appealed to their emotion and their sense of grievance. And so I don't know whether he believes any of these things himself or not, but he has cultivated a loyal following in people who share these fears and this vision.
And you take that one more step. You talk about this as a way of disinformers gaining power, which is the propaganda gets repeated over and over again. And I think one of the things that Trump has long said now is they're coming after me because they really want to come after you. I've never really been able to make that connection, but yet they buy that. Yes, they really want us, and they're coming. That's not too far away from they're coming for all your guns.
Yeah. Yes. You know, this idea that I am your protector, I'm your Superman, only I can fix it. That is, you know, one of the tropes of authoritarians throughout history, Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini and Putin. I'm strong. I will make you profitable. You know, you can overlook all of my despicable habits because I am here for you. And, you know, this idea of pitting people against each other, sowing divisions in society, and suggesting it's this us versus them. You know, one of the things we've heard a restoration of, and this is echoes of the past, is this idea of the great replacement theory, that white people are being replaced by some other group. You know, in Hitler's Germany, it was Jewish people. In today's society, it's immigrants, that the Democratic Party wants to bring in undocumented immigrants into this country and let them vote because that's the way they will win elections. And they're here to take your job and to take what's rightfully yours. Same with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, you know, just designed to be more inclusive to other people, portraying that as these other people are here to take what is rightfully yours. And so that's this idea that Donald Trump is just, you know, standing in the way that all these people, these bad people want to come and replace the white Christians who have been here for generations with these other bad people. And it's all part of a global plot. That's why globalism is so bad. And we have to put America first because we are the chosen people. There's certainly Christian nationalism tied into all of this too, that, you know, the United States is exceptional because we are God's chosen country, a promised land for Christians and for a Christian nation, which of course is a complete distortion of the actual founding of our country and what our Constitution actually says.
There are times we can take a message that somebody sends and try and recast it. Recently, a former President Trump made the comment about there will be bloodshed. He was talking about the car industry, said there will be bloodshed. Many people took it as a much broader concept, but then his people basically said, no, he was talking about the car industry. I get that kind of manipulation. The kind of maneuver I don't understand are so many of the Republicans who, after January 6th, went after him and basically, you know, denounced what had happened and put responsibility on him, from Mitch McConnell to Lindsey Graham. You can go on and on. And then you fast forward to now, and they've literally gone 180 in public statements. You can show them video of when they said the opposite, and that doesn't matter either.
Yeah. So, you know, this idea of disinformation, some people are deceived by it. There are certainly some Americans who genuinely believe this election was stolen. And then there are plenty of others who know better but are willing to go along with the con because they see which way the political winds are blowing. I think after January 6th, it never occurred to them that Trump would retain supporters after this hideous display that we saw on the Capitol, this attack with more than 1,000 people now who've been charged with crimes. And yet there's some people who like Trump even more now than they ever did before. And so I think people like Mitch McConnell and others, are perhaps surprised to see that, but they're willing to put their political interests ahead of the best interests of the country. Now, there certainly have been some courageous Republicans like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and Mitt Romney, people who are willing to admit what they saw that day. But those who have really lost their political clout. Liz Cheney lost her election. Adam Kinzinger and Mitt Romney chose not to run for reelection. It seems these days that it's impossible to be a successful Republican and still tell the truth about what happened on January 6th.
One of the things Republicans have always prided themselves are they're protecting the blue. They back the blue. They're all about the police and claim the Democrats want to defund the police. Yet when the Capitol 6 police officers testified before Congress, I remember, I'll leave the host name out of it, but watching one of the Fox News evening shows, and the comment was made they should all get Academy Awards for their performances, basically saying that everything they talked about was a lie. You know what I'm talking about. How do you present yourself as, I back the blue, I support the police, and yet when it comes to that day, you can just ignore the death of the officers who died? You can claim it wasn't resulting of it, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. How do you integrate all of that as consistent?
Yeah, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, in these cultures that are sort of post-truth, consistency doesn't matter. So, for example, in Putin's Russia, there's a great writer named Peter Pomerantsev who writes about Putin's Russia. And the idea of consistency is not just disregarded, but inconsistency is the rule of the day. And so you might hear one day that missiles were fired by Russia. The next day you'll hear that, no, those missiles were fired by Ukraine. And the next day it's, no, those missiles were fired by NATO. And well, which is it? And the goal is it doesn't matter because we're just going to say whatever we need to say at the moment to satisfy our short-term goals. And we don't care about hypocrisy. We don't care about inconsistency. And the net result of that is you will become cynical and then numb and then exhausted, and you will disengage from politics altogether. And that's right where the authoritarian wants you. And so this idea of you're being inconsistent and I'm going to quibble with the details, they don't care. All they care about is winning their team. And it doesn't matter what the issue is, what the logic is, what the argument is. I just want my team to win.
Related to that, you write in the book about stubbornness. Basically, mm-hmm. that when people form an impression, they are really resistant to change it. That's related here, right?
It is. And this is actually just a normal cognitive function of all of us that we're stubborn. It is the way we're wired. We're actually wired to win arguments because we're social creatures. And so the way for us to prevail is to argue that we deserve the biggest cave and the largest piece of saber-tooth tiger steak. That's how we're wired, and to not concede any ground, to not admit when we're wrong. It's why it's so hard and so painful to admit when you're wrong. And when somebody points out a mistake, so many people become very defensive and want to dig deeper and say, no, I'm right. Here's why. Rather than to stop digging and to reconsider our position. So we're wired that way. And so when someone tells us that, guess what, you've been duped by Donald Trump, he is a snake oil salesman, the instinct for most people is to not admit it and to double down. In fact, I saw this when I was a prosecutor. I talked in my book about a doctor who lied to patients about having cancer so that he could cure them with expensive chemotherapy treatments. And it was very difficult for many of those patients to realize and admit that they had been duped. Same with, you know, fraud victims. People feel shame and embarrassment when they have been a victim of crime. And, you know, that absolutely should not be the case. We should give people the grace to say, you did nothing wrong here. It's this manipulator who did something wrong to you. And yet people don't want to admit that they were duped. And so as a result, they tend to double down when, even when they might actually be doubting the position of the person they're supporting.
And I guess at one level, it's all, you know, it makes sense to sort of say when we have these discussions or these disagreements, all the concepts we've been talking about fit in. Then there's those group of people, that group of people who takes the extra step. I'm thinking about the recent situations of swatting or other kinds of hate crimes where people have this disinformation impact them in a way that actually has them take a step, which then puts their own freedom at risk. Now, of course, there's the January 6th people who took that step. But Donald Trump has now reframed that, so we're to look at them as patriots and heroes.
Yeah, no, that's the idea that the January 6th defendants, Donald Trump is now referring to as hostages, and really trying to revise the history of that and spin them as great patriots instead of vigilantes who engaged in violence. It's really shocking to me, you know, the day that event happened, I was just sick to my stomach watching these people marauding all over our capital, our, you know, temple of democracy. And yet I think that it's not surprising that people take the bait. You know, my background is as a national security prosecutor, and I saw the ways that Al-Qaeda and ISIS recruited people online by stirring their emotions. You know, they radicalized people and called them to action, and they make people think that you don't just have a license to engage in violence. You have a duty to engage in violence because these people are trampling on our rights. They're stealing our democracy. If you're a great patriot, you have to answer the call and do something about this. And so people who hear that enough become radicalized to action. And that's what we're starting to see. There's a phrase called stochastic terrorism. And this is something that ISIS propagated. The idea of just, you know, putting sermons out there online and telling people to act where you are. You don't need to travel anywhere in the world. Just use your car, use your gun, use a sword or knife and attack as many people and kill as many people as you can. And you will be doing great glory for the cause of our Islamic caliphate. In the same way, when Donald Trump talks about there's going to be a bloodbath, you know, you might not know who or where or when or why, but somebody's going to take the bait and somebody's going to say, Donald Trump did not get elected. And so I'm your bloodbath. Here I am. When he claimed that FBI agents planted evidence at his Mar-a-Lago home, the next day, a man tried to breach the FBI office in Cincinnati with an assault weapon. He was chased away and he was later killed in a standoff with police. So people are taking the bait, whether it's threats or swatting. It is making our country less safe. It is creating political violence, and I worry that it's going to drive good people from office. There are good people already leaving office because of this ugliness, and I worry that good people are not going to stick their neck out there for these thankless jobs if they know it comes with risk to their lives and the lives of their family members.
Well, you're talking about those public figures there, and I understand that, but let's talk about people like yourself who worked for DOJ for many years, or like me, who actually trained DOJ for 25 years. It is a common thing for me to say on our air when it's relevant to the discussion that people who are frontline prosecutors or people who work for DOJ are not political people. This whole notion that that Biden has weaponized the Department of Justice, which is so widely accepted by Trump and other Republicans. And no matter how much I say on the air that working with them, that, you know, there may be a certain level of political, look at the attorney general, you can get to a political figure in the process. But the typical frontline prosecutors or people who did what you would do, they're just not motivated by politics.
Yeah, that's right. You know, at the very highest levels, you have some political appointees at the Department of Justice. But by and large, the rank and file prosecutors at the Department of Justice throughout our state systems, in our police departments, are ordinary people who are nonpartisan. They're not bipartisan. They're just nonpartisan. They're apolitical. They do not discuss politics. They don't care about politics. They care about doing their job. I mean, some of them are interested in politics and their personal lives, I suppose. But to the extent that there is a political preference among this group, that most of them are Republicans. That, you know, you talk about a commitment to the blue and law and order. Many of them are Republicans, but they don't bring their politics to work. In fact, the worst thing you could say about somebody who works in one of these public service jobs is to call them political, because prosecutors and law enforcement officers work very hard to avoid politics. They want to be based on facts and law and nonpartisan. And so the idea that, you know, there's some deep state and they're all out to get Donald Trump is absolutely absurd.
I think mostly maybe lawyers have an easier time understanding that. I'm not sure. But how does a mind that believes that the current president, Joe Biden, has weaponized the DOJ? I will always say to them, how do you square the fact that if he truly controlled DOJ, he would let his son get indicted? I'm thinking that if I was president of the United States, I don't think I'd let my son get indicted. I would stop it. Biden can't. He didn't.
That just shows you how evil Joe Biden is, Paul. He could stop it and he chooses not to.
Didn't even care about
rather
his son.
Use it to cling to power. Yeah, no, he doesn't control it. You know, in ordinary times, and I don't know how it worked in the Trump administration because that was far from ordinary times, but there is not communication between the White House and the Department of Justice about charging decisions. Those are separate and apart. Those are post-Watergate norms that and policies that have existed to avoid any appearance that the Justice Department is governed by politics. It is based on facts, law, and DOJ policy when charging decisions are made. And so, you know, these ideas that all the prosecutors who've charged Joe Biden are doing the bidding of who've charged Donald Trump are doing the bidding of Joe Biden just doesn't land at all. He even claims that the state prosecutors, Fani Willis in Georgia and Alvin Bragg in New York, are doing the bidding of Joe Biden. You know, they don't answer to him. They're a separate governmental entity. And in the same way, you know, the attorney general and the special counsel most certainly don't answer to Joe Biden. It's why a special counsel was put in place to avoid any appearance that someone in the line of command under Biden is calling the shots here.
Last question before we get to the fixes, because I am in the camp that thinks Merrick Garland waited too long to take action to what he did. Merrick Garland grew up. I grew up in Skokie. I went to school with his sister. And so I get all of that. I do think he waited too long. But I also think, given what we've kind of all know about him, he probably didn't want anything to look political. So things waited. Although he would tell you things panned out as they panned out. The point is, when you have somebody who is a master of controlling information or disinformation, the truth is, whether Garland indicted Trump a year earlier or when he did, Trump was ready for it.
Yeah, the only danger, I suppose, is that it is quite possible now that the federal election interference case will not come to trial before the election. And then if Trump is elected, he will have the power to appoint an attorney general who will dismiss that case. Same with the Mar-a-Lago case. So that's the only downside of waiting as long as he did. I'm not so much in the camp of criticizing Merrick Garland because I think we don't know what we don't know. I think it's quite possible there are things going on behind the scenes where they were exploring and investigating quietly before they went more overt. And we saw some things, you know, that involved litigation of privileges and things when we started to know what was actually going on. So until the history of this chapter is written, where we know what, you know, how quickly they worked, I'll withhold my criticism there.
Fair enough. Let's talk about you talk about the solutions here, the fixes on a supply and on a demand side. On the supply side, you talk about needing to regulate the process. We could get into, you know, amending Rule 230 and stuff. But the bottom line is, for the average viewer or listener who's paying attention to this, what advice do you have for them to not be influenced? Or not to be, I should say, we're on the supply side, not to be somebody who provides disinformation if they're trying not to.
So if you are not wanting to push false information out there, I think that there are a number of things that you can do. One of which is, you know, make sure before you forward a message that contains false information, you know, read the story, not just the headline. Look and see if there's a second source before you get excited and pass something along. If there is some conclusion that is drawn, take a look and think critically. Is this causation or only correlation? If there is some statistical study, ask yourself, what was the size of the sample set? Was it 3 million or was it 3? Because all of those things can make a difference. And so I think to avoid being part of the problem, we need to avoid sending things that are false. I also think, Paul, we need to avoid just piling on the snark, because that is one of the things that really lowers the level of discourse to just fighting with each other all the time. If we want to get past this feelings over thought, we need to engage in rational argument and not just browbeating each other. And a lot of that takes place online.
You know what the best part about doing this interview right now is? that I send questions all the time for hashtag sisters in law, but they don't get picked for the show. So I have a question you're going to get right now and you can't escape me. And but it's related to this. It's related. That's why I kept it here. And that is this. There are some analysts on TV who are saying, you know, once Trump becomes the nominee of the Republican Party, he must get security briefings. It's just the way it is. There are some I've heard on television say, no, you can't do it. He's proved himself not worthy of briefings for all the reasons that you would be aware of. We can't trust it. He'll keep it quiet. Nancy Pelosi herself said, yeah, you got to give him briefings. There's no way around it. But we really need to ask him to act properly with it. My question for you as it relates to the disinformation, what, if anything, can the providers of security information do to prevent on the other side it being used improperly, given the fact that they're probably required to give him briefings?
Yeah, that's a really difficult situation, I think, for the FBI. I agree they probably are required to give him briefings. It's a norm. It's not a law. I don't know. You know, we've never had a candidate under indictment before for willfully retaining classified information, national defense information. So maybe they can push back and fight it. And maybe that's what they should do.
But that'll look political. That's the danger.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a crime to disclose classified information. He's no longer the president. And so if he were to take this information and disclose it, that's the lever they have over him, which is if this gets into the public domain and we're able to attribute it to you, you could be charged with a crime. Now, he's already been charged in four big cases, and it doesn't seem to slow him down any. So I don't know what it would deter me, but I don't know if it deters other people. But I think that's the lever that they have over him from just, you know, disclosing selectively, you know, cherry picked nuggets that might help him.
In your book, you talk about some fixes on the demand side, adult education, media literacy. I mean, they're great suggestions, but let me just be practical for a moment. There may be people who say, my life is too busy. I don't have time to educate myself in that way to avoid it. Is there any suggestion you can give? Like, for example, one of the things I do, I watch MSNBC, Newsmax, CNN, Fox. I watch them all. Because the way I feel like I can keep a balance in my role as analyst, because I'm not a commentator, the way I keep my role as analyst is to say, I want to know what everybody's saying out there and take it all in. Is that a decent way to try and avoid?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it's one of the things I recommend. You know, I think sometimes people get in an information bubble. I hear from a lot of friends that my parents sit in front of the TV and watch Fox News all day. That's all they hear again and again. And it has really shaped their view of the world. I think that, you know, the best way to be a consumer of news is to read, watch, listen to a lot of different sources, because even credible news outlets are making editorial choices about what they're going to share with you. And it may be because of their worldview about what is a priority. But if you want to know everything that's going on, you might need to look to different outlets. For example, it might be that, say, I don't know, MSNBC is not reporting a lot on immigration issues at the border. Fox News is reporting about nothing else but immigration news at the border. If you watch both, then maybe you'll learn about those things. Or maybe you watch the BBC, which is a little bit of an arm's length from what's going on in the United States. And maybe you'll get a more objective view. I think you need to read. I think you need to listen and you need to watch. So if you can mix up your diet, you know, it's like a healthy diet, Paul. You got to have a few orange things on your plate and a few green things on your plate. You can't just eat, a steady diet of one thing.
Fortunately, M&Ms are made in all those colors, so it works out just fine for me. We're just about out of time. So just a personal question I have for you, not terribly personal, but in many ways, our tracks have tracked each other a little bit. That is to say, I practiced law. I was a law school dean and professor for a long time. But when I got into television in 1986, that for me became the place that I thought I can really teach the most, so to speak. There's the training and all that, but TV's really made a difference. Your path is not all that dissimilar from that. Do you find, is TV, is it sort of like if somebody said, Barb, it's time to leave the teaching, leave everything, it's time to just be on TV? Would you go for that? Or would you say, no, what I do with students is too important?
Oh, yeah. I think what I do with students is what makes me go. I think of the television commentary as kind of an extension of teaching. The teaching is where you actually can have, you know, personal relationships with students and mentoring. That's the part of it that I like the best. But I do see, speaking on MSNBC and trying to explain the law, just another outlet for teaching. So, I love it when people say thank you for your clarity and helping me to understand what's going on. That's, I'm not trying to shape anybody's opinions. I'm just trying to give people adequate information so that they can understand the law in the news.
I respect that greatly. The podcast to listen to is hashtag sisters-in-law. Don't forget the hashtag or you end up with this group in Australia. That's how I first started. The book is called Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. But I don't know how you knew this was going to be our life bar, but your notion, because I know you have to start writing books years earlier. Brilliant to come up with this topic. One of the most important books that we can be reading today.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for being with me. Give my best to my former student, Eve Brensicki Primus. Always like to say that.
We'll do.
And I'll see you again soon. Hopefully see you in Chicago. Thank you, Barb.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.